In this part of Focus, we'll be talking about politics in Canada and talking a little bit about the financial scandal that has been roiling Canadian politics now for a number of months. It's a financial scandal involving Canada's ruling Liberal Party. So far, the Liberals have managed to survive a number of no-confidence votes, perhaps in part because the Conservatives aren't particularly interested in a new election anytime soon, and apparently Canadian voters aren't either. However, the scandal has damaged both the Liberal Party and the Prime Minister, Paul Martin. In a survey earlier this year, only 25% of Canadians said that they would vote for the Liberals if new elections were held. This morning, in this part of Focus, we'll talk a little bit about Canadian politics with our guest, Richard Johnston. He is Distinguished University Scholar and head of the Department of Political Science at the University of British Columbia and has been following Canadian politics for some time. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, you're listening around Illinois and Indiana or on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use the toll-free line. That is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455, anyplace else. Professor Johnston, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Not at all.
We appreciate it. Perhaps just for people who have not been following this closely, we should begin by talking a little bit about just what this financial scandal is all about.
Well, it's sometimes called the sponsorship scandal. It originated with basically clandestine expenses intended to combat what seemed to be the threat of separatist sentiment and separatist mobilization in Quebec in the late 90s, around and after the 1995 referendum. It turned into basically a patronage scam with quite a lot of sort of hidden slush being sent out to Liberal Party supporters, ad firms, this sort of stuff. In many cases, contracts were let for jobs that just weren't done. And then it eventually became clear that there was kickbacks going on, and a whole tissue of pretty sleazy stuff, which finally broke with a report from the Auditor General, who's basically the chief accountant of Parliament, last year. Then an inquiry was set up by the Prime Minister to try and defuse the question. The inquiry itself has taken on a life of its own. And this whole thing has produced a huge political reaction, especially in Quebec. Mm.
The misdeeds, the alleged misdeeds, took place in the late 90s. And it wasn't, as you say, until February of last year that the Auditor General issued this report and this story broke. Why did it take such a long time for why was it such a long time between the events and the story breaking?
I don't really have a detailed answer to that, but you know, part of the story is it was clandestine. People covered their tracks, and the government was a majority government for most of this time, so Parliament didn't have much political leverage over it. It was one of those things, though, where I think a lot of people knew that something was about to break, and then the Auditor General's report was kind of the thing that caused the dam to burst. But the political culture of Ottawa and the organization of activity in Ottawa is actually quite secretive. It's quite different from the U.S. It is, in some ways, the most executive-dominated, some would almost say Stalinist, administration in the democratic world.
That's going some way, I would say, making a statement like that. The current Prime Minister, Paul Martin, he was finance minister at the time that this took place. He says he didn't know anything about it. The former Prime Minister, Jean Chrétien, said he didn't know anything about it. How deep into the Liberal Party is knowledge about this?
I think probably this is one of those areas of plausible deniability, a term that you may remember from 35 or 30 years ago. I think that the thing was set up to give people plausible deniability. Someone like Martin probably had inklings that things were going on, chose not to look. The Prime Minister probably knew more than he had, that is, Prime Minister Chrétien, probably knew more than he is letting on. But again, you know, basically let others do it.
Hmm. Well, In the great scheme of things, just how serious is this? How serious a shock is this to the fortunes of the Liberals?
I think in the long run, probably not that great. There have been scandals like this before. I think, though, the problem is, the long-term problem has been that Quebec has historically been a pivot of the Liberal Party. It's not so pivotal anymore, but it's still important. There is the fear of separatism, sovereignty, separation, that seems to license extraordinary events. And so we've gone through cycles like this in the past. I think the real question is whether the Liberal Party can ever recover a semblance of its fortunes in Quebec. Because, as I mentioned, Quebec has kind of been one of the pillars of Liberal strength politically. Now it's not such a pillar. And if it can't recover serious ground in Quebec, its prospects of ever being a majority governing party may be permanently weakened.
Hmm. I wonder, for Mr. Martin himself, he at the time this story broke, he hadn't been prime minister very long. He only became prime minister in December of 2003.
Months, that's right. He'd been prime minister for mere months. But the preceding decade had seen a kind of guerrilla warfare inside the Liberal Party. And that's part of what's going on here, that you had at the top, a kind of effective working combination between Chrétien and Martin, but the two had been rivals for the leadership in 1990. The rivalry continued. There was a kind of de facto truce through much of the 90s, but then as Chrétien decided to stay on and stay on, the Martin forces turned on the heat. So there was a kind of, there's no love lost between the camps inside the Liberal Party, and when the time finally arrived for Martin to take the leadership, there was a deep resentment inside the party in some circles of the way in which he took it over.
Mm-hmm. So maybe we could talk a little bit about the way that this has affected the parliament. Now, we talked about the fact that Mr. Martin, he became prime minister at the end of 2003, and that just after he'd been prime minister a few months, the story broke. This was in the winter, February of 2004. There were elections in June 2004, and I think that a lot of people believe that the Liberal Party lost its majority in elections in that June because of this scandal and because that Canadian voters were unhappy?
Absolutely. That is what happened. The Liberals lost ground in Quebec where they had expected to gain, and most critically, they lost about 25 seats in Ontario, and that's what basically deprived them of their majority. In much of the rest of the country, it was kind of the status quo, including in this province.
So it seems, I guess, one of the things that I have a hard time understanding is how it is that, you know, we come to the point where we have minority government, we have a weakened Liberal Party, we have a lot of voters who are really unhappy. One can imagine a lot of other places that what would happen simply is that there would be a no-confidence vote, the government would lose, that would be the end of the government, and we'd have to have new elections. And so far that hasn't happened. It sounds as if that might have been close a couple of times, but at least the closest it ever came was at this one point where there was a vote, and I believe that it was actually about the budget, but somebody, one guy changed his mind, and the Liberals managed to pull it out of the fire by one vote, and since that time, their position looks slightly stronger. But again, I guess I find myself going back to the question is how it is that the government has managed to stay in power.
Well, the incident you describe was it really was unprecedented. There was a close precedent in 1926, but the government, on a key confidence vote, it was on the budget, it was a parliamentary tie. And the key person who created the tie was a former Conservative, or I should say former Alliance and Reform Party member, Chuck Cadman, an independent MP from Surrey. Independent MPs are very rare in the Canadian situation. Cadman supported the government. That created the tie, and the Speaker simply broke the tie in favor of the status quo. But the basic underlying story is that we're at a kind of impasse. On one hand, the Liberal Party, which is kind of the almost permanent party of government, certainly the most strongly positioned party year in, year out, decade in, decade out, it is now weaker than it has ever been in its history, at least since the 1920s. At the same time, the presumptive alternative, the Conservative Party, which kind of bolted itself back together after a disaster in 1993, the Conservative Party, even in its strengthened form, is still not really feasible as an alternative party of government. It has no presence in Quebec, which is a quarter of the House of Commons, and it has only a weak presence in Ontario. The leader of the Conservative Party and of the opposition, Stephen Harper, believed a month ago that his party was poised, if not to get a majority government, at least to get a working minority through another election. And that's why he was trying to force the issue, force a confidence vote, and bring the government down. But underneath him, the ground was shifting, even as he was pursuing this strategy. His party is deeply divided between social conservatives and cultural conservatives, particularly with Western roots, and a more general sort of fiscally, economically conservative, but socially otherwise neutral group. And the cracks within the ranks of the Conservative Party started to appear, even as they seemed poised to bring the government down. And the critical crack was the defection of Belinda Stronach, who had been the runner-up in the leadership convention last year. So Belinda Stronach, her move is more than just arithmetic. Her move alters the arithmetic of the parliamentary situation, but it's also symptomatic of real problems that the Conservatives have. Just to give you a hint of that, even if there is an election shortly and British Columbians decide that they want to punish Liberals along the way, the Conservatives could wind up losing as many as 7 seats as a result of British Columbians' desire to punish the Liberals. Now, fancy that.
That's I guess I don't quite see how that happens.
Well, you have a number of constituencies, especially in BC, a few as well as Ontario, that are basically three-way races.
Hmm.
And the party that may actually gain in all of this is the NDP. The NDP are, however, an ally of the Liberals, at least at this point. They'd rather not be shackled to the Liberals, but that's the way they are. They are the Liberals' chief ally in Parliament right now. They're likely to be next year, and they may actually gain seats. It's entirely possible that the Liberals will lose maybe 15 or 20 seats, but the Liberal-NDP combination may grow by just enough to give themselves a stronger working majority than they have now. Mm. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous.
Also, I wonder about how public opinion's running these days, because I do, from what stories I've read, make it sound as if, while on the one hand there are many Canadians that are very unhappy and particularly unhappy with the Liberals, they're not particularly eager to go through another election.
They're not eager to go through another election, and they're not particularly attracted to the Conservatives. But in particular, they just kind of want all this stuff to quiet down and go away for a while.
Mm. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Richard Johnston. He is Distinguished University Scholar and head of the Department of Political Science at the University of British Columbia. And we're talking about some of the things that have been going on in Canadian politics in recent months. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. I was just thinking, as you were talking a little bit about the factions within the Conservative Party in Canada, it sounds a little bit like the Republican Party in the United States. Are the Conservatives and the Liberals in any way roughly analogous? And I ask the question as a way of maybe helping Americans understand Canadian politics a little bit better. Any sort of parallels between the Conservatives and the Liberals in Canada and Conservatives, Liberals, Republicans, Democrats here in the United States?
Sure they are. I mean, there's a sense in which the center of the Canadian spectrum is to the left of that of the U.S., but there are strong parallels. The difference is that the divisions within each party, on each side of the political ledger at least, have not had the same effect on the ability of each party to function. So the fact that the Republicans are divided between social conservatives and economic conservatives, they seem to have made their peace with each other long enough at least to allow a working coalition, a working majority indeed, for the Republicans to function. In the Canadian side, the various pieces of the conservative puzzle, which have a lot of similarities to the U.S., just don't seem to be as functional. They can't seem to be able to draw the compromises that their U.S. counterparts have. There is, I think, an additional element, and that is that the regional part of support for the parties also works to the Conservatives' disadvantage. Too many of their MPs are from the West and are, in some sense, articulating a kind of contentless Western perspective, which is kind of hard to make work in a Westminster context in which you have to try and form a national government.
Mm-hmm. How long has the Liberal Party been the dominant party in Canadian politics?
Since 1896.
That's a pretty good track record.
Yep.
1896.
They're sort of the government about 75% of the time.
And what has enabled them to be that successful?
Well, over the long pull, a critical part of that success has been their strength in Quebec. Until 1984, the Liberals typically got 80% or so of the seats in Quebec, almost regardless of what their popular vote was. In other words, the Liberals would roll out with something like one seat in four in the House of Commons already locked up before the election even began. And so that's a huge strategic advantage. They don't have that anymore. Now their base is in Ontario. Ontario, of course, is the biggest province. It's about 40% of the total, over a third of the seats in the House of Commons. So they've tended to have a strong regional base somewhere, historically in Quebec, currently in Ontario. They've been the party best able to broker the kind of cultural, linguistic, and in the more distant past, religious divides that that define the country's politics. So they're the supreme balancing act.
Certainly in this country, there are regional differences in how people think, in what issues are most important to them. But it seems that perhaps in Canada, those differences are more dramatic than they are in the United States. People maybe feel a much, much greater tension between the idea that they are a Westerner or that they're from New Brunswick or that they are a Quebecer, greater tension between that identity and their identity as a Canadian.
Well, you've got to be careful about that. As a practical matter, most Canadians in most parts of the country are Canadian first, and it's a pretty uncomplicated sense of membership. The heart of the matter is Quebec. Quebec, in some sense, is a nation within a nation, right? It's the heartland of the country, historically speaking, going back to the 17th century, and it is a conquered province going back to the 18th century. So there is a sense of nationality in Quebec that you don't find in the other provinces, and Quebec politics is defined by the struggle over whether or not Quebec shall be a nation. So that's the central thing. The nearest equivalent would be the South in the U.S. before the Civil War. But we haven't had our Civil War yet, so those questions are still alive. In the rest of the country, to the extent that regional identification intrudes, the fact is it's basically Alberta. The rest of us actually aren't terribly preoccupied by it, but Alberta is. Alberta tends to talk about the West, but the West is sort of what you can see from the tallest building in Calgary as far as Alberta is concerned. But to a large extent, the Alberta issue is driven by reaction to Quebec. There's no substance to it. There's no sort of distinctively Western thing that people actually want. And in terms of attitudes on policy questions, The differences across the country are actually relatively modest. BC and Quebec tend to be the most liberal, for example, on social policy questions. Alberta is not all that peculiarly conservative on those questions, although it's more conservative than BC. No place in Canada is as conservative on social policy questions as the South is, for example. But BC and Quebec are probably no more liberal on social policy questions than New England or California.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Why don't we do that? Someone listening in Champaign County, and we will go right there. Line number one. Hello.
Hi, good morning. I have a number of things, and I guess I'll just spew them out and end up with U.S.-Canadian relations. But I thought I'd start with, since the NDP is the swing vote, generally, despite the fact that I guess the budget was dependent on this independent fellow, what does that say about generally more progressive domestic policy? The implications of this ruling in Quebec on the healthcare system, I'd like for you to explain that to us again, because I didn't quite get it. On U.S.-Canadian relations, which it seems to me we have two sort of examples of, Martin changing a little bit in this and not on another. Well, I think the Haitian intervention was sort of, and I've heard a couple Canadian commentators say that Martin coming in and wanting to have better relations after the Iraq disputation, that there was something to that. The Chrétien was less inclined to intervene in the way that we have this chaos down there now. But the other thing, in example of Martin being defiant, is this business about the nuclear shield, missile defense, as it's called. And was the ham-handedness of the Bush administration important in forcing Martin to not find a way to sort of cooperate on missile defense? I mean, what they did is they didn't have any diplomatic discussions in advance, and Bush announced it while he was visiting Canada, and it was blindsiding Martin, so there was sort of no way for him to finesse it. There's a lot there, and I guess I'll hang up and listen, and maybe I'll call back if I need a colloquy. Thanks.
Okay.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Shall I just start?
Just plunge right in.
Okay. The dependence of the Liberals on the NDP clearly pulls the whole system to the left, and you can see that in the government's own budget. It had to modify its budget to get NDP support as it realized its position was weakening, and this presumably will only continue. Ironically, though, it's not just the NDP. Even though the Bloc Québécois are an implacable foe of the government, they are not so suicidal that they would oppose gestures in social and foreign policy to the left. And so the government has also been very attentive to the fact that Quebec, generally speaking, opinion in Quebec stands to the left of the rest of the country, and that includes on foreign policy. So let me just actually go straight over to foreign policy. The Bush administration's blindsided certainly was not welcome, though in a way it actually helped the prime minister dramatize his differences with the president. My sense, though, is that the real story in terms of the Martin government's tacking on Canada-U.S. relations has more to do with its political weakness. I think it's pretty clear to me that the prime minister wanted to sign on to missile defense. If you look at the rhetoric in the campaign last June, every time that he got hit from the left, either from the Bloc Québécois or from the NDP, he would say, "We are opposed to the weaponization of space," which was a finesse. But I think that in the end, he realized that politically, he wasn't going to be able to sustain signing on to missile defense, partly because most of his own caucus didn't approve, but he just simply didn't have the political strength to force it through. And so he's, in some sense, reflecting the reluctance in the country as a whole. And as far as the role in Iraq is concerned, I think that there's just no support. There was no support for Canadian involvement in the military sense there, and the government was registering that very sensitively, all the more so because of its political weakness. The healthcare ruling pulls in the other direction. I mean, it's a bit of a judicial accident, but the fact that the Supreme Court has said that it's actually, ironically, it's the Quebec Charter, not the national Charter of Rights and Freedoms, but the court has said that the Quebec Charter says that people cannot be forced, or people cannot be denied the opportunity to go outside the public system in order to get timely care. That's a bombshell, and if that ruling finds echoes in the courts in other provinces, it could actually unravel the basis of universal compulsory health care, the fundamentals of the Canadian system. So this is an instance where courts have actually, I think, potentially had a huge impact of a reactionary sort on a major piece of social policy.
Again, questions are welcome from people who are listening, 333-9455. That's for Champaign Urbana. We do also have a toll-free line that no matter where you are listening, you can use that. That's 800-222-9455. And again, we're talking this morning about Canadian politics, and our guest is Professor Richard Johnston. He's political scientist at the University of British Columbia. I'd like to return for a moment to the subject of Quebec. And as you explained, I hope that I have this right, that perhaps the reason that the scandal and the weakness of the Liberal Party matters is that within Quebec, the Liberals have been the majority party and that they tend to be pro-Canada. That is, they oppose the withdrawal of Quebec from Canada. And so that makes one raise the question, if the Liberals are weakened, and the Parti Québécois would manage to be the leading party, then would that tip the balance in the favor of Quebec withdrawing? Now, and also bearing in mind this is something that has been discussed and debated for some time now, does that really, if the Liberals were significantly weakened nationally and also in Quebec, does that really energize at all that debate and indeed tip the balance at all in the direction of those people who would like to see Quebec withdraw from the rest of Canada?
In the short run, yes, it does tip the balance in the sense that the number of Federalist MPs, non-separatist MPs in Ottawa, is already small and may shrink further, and relatively few of them may be French-Canadians as opposed to people from sort of other English and other language backgrounds. That doesn't help. At the same time, the government of the province of Quebec, which is also a Liberal government, it's politically very weak. It's very unpopular. It's fighting skirmishes on all sorts of fronts. It's unlikely to win the next election. So the Parti Québécois will probably get back in power. Now, so those two things are good news for separatists. On the other hand, there's a couple of other things at work that are helpful from the Federalist point of view. First of all, the Parti Québécois itself, the provincial party, is divided over how it should approach the question of sovereignty, and it's now plunged into a leadership battle with the surprise retirement of Bernard Landry. And at this point, at least, the potential candidates for the leadership of the party that have the most popular appeal are the least hard line. The other thing that's important is that in the aftermath of the 1995 referendum and some litigation, the government of Canada decided to basically tighten the rules for referendums. Not that it can set the rules for referendums in Quebec, but basically it said any question coming out of Quebec, if you expect us to respond, has to be a clear question. And no more fudging questions as both of the 95 and the 1980 referendums had, which they were as much about association with Canada as they were about sovereignty. So there's an act called the Clarity Act, which forces clarity on the situation, that the government of Canada said, we are not simply going to sit back and take the results of just any vote as indicative of what Quebecers want out of this thing. So the bar has been raised. But we could well be embarked on a period of further constitutional crisis.
When that referendum was held in 1995, those who favored remaining in Canada won narrowly.
That's right.
Is there any thinking that if we simply conducted an opinion poll and we went out and asked people in Quebec which they favored remaining as part of Canada or withdrawing? What's the latest that anyone could say about how people feel?
Well, in terms of questions framed the way they traditionally have been, you know, are you in favor of sovereignty? It's gone up a bit in the last few years, as it tends to do whenever there's any kind of political crisis that puts Ottawa in a bad odor. Underneath, though, if you put the question, you know, are you prepared to be an independent country, no longer a part of Canada? The support for that position still tends to be well short of a majority. The key is whether or not Quebecers' minds can be focused on that question and not some mollifying alternative wording of the thing that makes it seem as if it's just a negotiating position inside the Federation.
Well, if you, setting aside just how difficult such a thing would be, if in the cold light of day you simply look at the question, could Quebec be an independent country, what would the answer be?
The answer would be, of course it could.
Hmm.
It probably wouldn't be quite as wealthy as it is now, but it still would be pretty wealthy. A big question would be whether the transition to independence would be so damaging because of tit-for-tat kinds of stuff or because of a loss of confidence in key markets. So, for example, you've got banks holding mortgages. What if the Montreal property market collapsed because of separatist fears? There could be huge bankruptcies. There'd be an issue of the value of the currency. There'd be a struggle over the division of the national debt, that sort of stuff. I mean, it's actually, there has never been a rich, consolidated industrial country like Canada split. Unless you count the separation of Ireland from the UK in 1922, basically. But that's Ireland was a lot smaller in relation to the UK than Quebec is in relation to Canada.
Let's talk with someone else who is listening here, a listener in Champaign, and this would be line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
You observed early on that the executive in Canada was, in fact, more independent, if I understood you correctly, more independent and more powerful within the Canadian system than the executive in the U.S. Do I have that right, and would you be willing to enlarge on that?
You do have it right. I did say that, and that is the situation. I mean, there's an irony here, but it's not peculiar to Canada. We just happen to be an exaggerated case, that where the constitution of the executive rests on control of a majority in the legislative branch, so a consolidated system rather than separated powers, that even though that creates the appearance of the executive being the creature of Parliament, it is commonly the case that in those situations the executive actually has more power, partly because it's in effect locked up by whatever means. A legislative majority for its program, and that's especially true where you've got single party governments, as you do under the Westminster system that we operate along with Australia, UK, and so on. It also is the case that, independently of that basic constitutional feature, we have the strongest executive in relation to the legislative side of things of any of the Westminster systems. So it's much harder, for example, to pry information out of the executive than it is even in the UK. Courts have tended to back cabinets and a culture of secrecy. Canadian governments tend to be dominated by their prime ministers and parties dominated by their cabinet more than is the case with their cousins in the UK or Australia, for example.
A couple of the examples you just discussed, the provincial court decision on health,
right,
and the missile imbroglio with the United States seem to suggest an executive that, in fact, was in trouble within its own system, that is, subject to this court and subject
right.
to factional concerns in the legislature.
Those are both fair points, well taken. And the with the missile thing, In effect, the claim that I made about executive dominance is contingent on a long history of single-party government. And that's changed, and we may not see it again in our lifetimes, as a matter of fact. So we may be actually starting down a path of shift in the balance. The place of the courts, the courts may be having that effect, too, as a result of the entrenchment of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms in the 25 years ago. So we now have judicial review that proceeds in a way sort of altogether familiar to US listeners,
mm-hmm.
which we didn't have.
Yes.
Not really, other than over sort of division of power in the Federation. This decision on Medicare is quite a stunner, actually.
Mutatis mutandis, would a Canadian prime minister be able to take Canada to war the way Blair and Bush did in their systems?
Actually, on that one, probably not. And here the big example, it was actually the way in which Canada went to war in 1939. On questions of war and peace, the country's a delicate equipoise, I guess you could say. And it's very striking that in 1939, even though in some sense some legal scholars would have said we were legally at war when the UK was at war, because after all, in whose name was that war fought? King George VI. The government of Canada summoned Parliament, had a debate, set the terms for participation, and did not officially issue a declaration of war until 1 week after hostilities had commenced in Europe in September 39. So that actually is a kind of a nice illustration of the of how the delicate coalitional balance in the country as a whole does constrain. On the other hand, once Canada went to war, it was pretty much total. And in the years following the war, the government of Canada actually had emergency measures legislation and reconstruction legislation that was extraordinarily top-down.
Thank you.
For years.
Thanks.
All right. Well, thanks for the call. Again, listeners are welcome to call in with questions. We have about 15 minutes left in the program. Our guest is Richard Johnston. He is a distinguished university scholar and head of the Department of Political Science at University of British Columbia. We're talking about Canadian politics, and questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Given the kinds of things that you've said about how powerful the Canadian executive is and how closed it is, in a sense. Will what has happened, led to greater demands by Canadians for more openness in government?
It might. There's a general sense in which there is a disconnect between the operation of power at the center in Canada, including at provincial capitals, and the presumptions and culture of the electorate at large. The voters themselves, federally at least, have in a sense been voting with their feet. If you look at the distribution of the popular vote over actually several decades, one of the things that's striking is that it has fractionalized. The effective number of parties in the Canadian electorate and even in Canada's parliament has grown, so that the empirical foundations of Westminster parliamentarism have been eroding. Those foundations assume that the system will operate to force coordination on everybody into one or the other of two alternative camps. Well, that coordination has broken down. It's been gradually breaking down, actually, for many decades. 1993 was kind of the extreme case. The reconstitution of the Conservative Party was a bit of a counter tendency, but there is a sense in which Canadians don't want to be corralled into one or the other of two parties. And to the extent that that is so, then the translation mechanism of votes into seats has broken down, and Canadians are struggling to recognize themselves in a way in the parliaments that they actually produce.
Well, just that perhaps gets to this question about in a larger sense, setting aside what happens in the shorter term, what this crisis means. Does this crisis indeed have some sort of larger meaning for Canadian politics? Does it shake things up more than simply shaking it up in the short term being a problem for Paul Martin and for the Liberal Party? And does it mean something more than that?
I believe it does. I mean, first of all, there's the whole question of Quebec, and we've talked about that. So that's back on the table in its own kind of dreary and distressing way. So we're going to have to deal with that. Second, though, I think that if it's the case, and it really does seem to be the case, that Parliament is at an impasse. We're not going to see a single-party majority government after the next election. We may not see one ever again. And if that's so, and party leaders start to ponder the implications of that, and strategically placed coalition partners like the NDP in particular start forcing the issue, we might see a change of electoral system. And that, in turn, will have a profound change on the way government is conducted in Canada. we could become a more European-style parliamentary regime with coalition governments as a matter of routine, for example.
With all of the chaos and problems that in governing that seem to come with them?
Well, chaos is actually not that typical of the European situation. I mean, it's natural to think of Italy, or I suppose Israel these days, in terms of parliamentary breakdown. But fact is, most parliamentary countries operate in the proportional framework and would never contemplate changing to the system that we use. You don't want to get into sort of far pastures being greener and all of that, but we're already in a situation of chaos. It's hard to imagine it being much worse.
Well, I suppose my mind was drifting to those places where famously they are the most chaotic, and I suppose the places that you mentioned would be the shining example.
Yeah, but you know, you might idealize Germany on the other side of it, extraordinarily orderly and intellectually quite rich politics, for example. Mm-hmm. So who knows?
Let's talk with an Urbana listener here. This is line number one. Hello.
Hello. I've enjoyed this conversation. I was living in Toronto in Canada at the end of the Trudeau era, and I'm wondering what parallels the Paul Martin situation is with the John Turner fiasco, where there was someone who was prime minister and waiting for a long time, was more or less anointed by the powers that be the successor to a long-standing prime minister, and there was just sort of a public fatigue with the party that dumped on this person, and you know, Turner's government went down in flames, and the situation is somewhat different apparently in terms of the conservative capacity to capitalize on this, but are there any parallels here where the Canadian people are just sort of, they've seen one prime minister too long, and the heir apparent who's been standing in the wings for a long time waiting sort of is the recipient of this sense of fatigue?
There certainly are parallels, more than you might think. Some of them are underlying. The Liberal Party has always been, or certainly has been since 1960, a site for tension between sort of the center and the center-left, where Trudeau was sort of center-left, Chrétien was sort of center-left, Turner was more center-right, Martin center-right. So there's an ideological parallel. There's some parallel in terms of kind of being in waiting, but that's a weaker one. I mean, John Turner lost to Trudeau in 1968, so it was 16 years later that he got his chance, and he'd been out of politics for over half that period. Whereas Martin had not gone out of politics, had left the cabinet only very recently, and had been waiting for a much shorter time, basically 13 years. So he was better poised in some sense than Turner was to take over. The other thing, though, and you did mention it, is that in 1984, the Liberals came up against a truly formidable appointment, or rather opponent, in Brian Mulroney. Not only was Mulroney pretty adept, but he held the key to the Quebec Bank. And that's sort of the central thing that made it possible for him to actually govern for 9 years. Stephen Harper is not as formidable opponent in that way, and he's only dug himself in deeper in the last few months. So it has often been said that, you know, the longevity of the Liberals is as much a result of the weakness of the Conservatives as anything else, and I think that illustrates this right now.
I think that it was true, though, that when Mr. Martin became Prime Minister, that some people at least were optimistic that better government would result, and that then as soon as the scandal broke, that Mr. Martin, I think he was at pains to say, well, that was then and this is now, and that was not on my watch, and trying to persuade people that it was still true that they could expect better government with him in leadership than with Mr. Chrétien. Did Canadians buy that?
Not really. I mean, and in doing that, in some ways, he opened up divisions within the ranks of the Liberal Party, or he rubbed them raw where they were already pretty raw from the leadership convention. But certainly he has tried to say that he's the, you know, he's the brush that's going to scour the pot clean, and it is he who set up the Gomery Commission and so on. But polls suggest that voters believe that Martin is at least partly responsible, and this is especially true in Quebec, where most of the political damage has been done.
Well, aside from this, what are some of the key issues now that are most important in Canadian politics?
Well, Canada-U.S. relations are just going to continue to be as important as ever, all the more so as the Bush administration tries to tighten the security fence and force the issue in foreign policy. Healthcare has been a matter of debate for several years. Funding issues. There's a lot of claims, at least, about lengthening queues for critical surgery and that sort of stuff. And the Quebec court decision has forced that debate out in the open. The cultural questions that are captured for the moment in same-sex marriage aren't going to go away. The Conservative Party, whether Stephen Harper wants to do this or not, it looks as if the Conservative Party is going to continue pursuing this agenda, partly because there are evangelical Christians in this country. They are mobilizing politically. They are taking control of Conservative Riding Associations. So we're going to hear more talk around that agenda. There's plenty of substance to talk about.
Well, I think one of the reasons that I was interested in having this conversation on this program that I do is that I thought that it would be a good idea for people to hear a little bit about politics in Canada. It's something that certainly on this station you can hear because for a long time we have run the program as it happens in the evenings. But here occasionally we also try to talk a little bit about Canada. Perhaps not enough, but it is at least a little bit. Let me ask you this question. Why is it that Canadian politics, do you think, should matter to Americans? I mean, I'll make the argument that we should at least be passingly familiar with what happens in Canada.
Well, I mean, we are going through many of the same debates as you, and it strikes me that one can learn from the way in which arguments take place in other places. Canadian and American societies are strikingly similar in so many ways, even though the center of gravity may be displaced relative to the other place. So there's that. We continue to be the largest trading partner, though that won't be true forever, but it is a massive trade relationship. The fact that we are often the targets of protectionist moves, especially in the recent years, has implications for American consumers as well as for producers. So there should be attention paid to that. We are a very large landmass and the northern frontier of North America, and to the extent that there are continuing homeland security issues, we're going to be part of that story, whether we like it or not, whether you like it or not. And decisions that the government of Canada takes will be critical to the security of North America.
Admittedly, Canada cannot ignore the United States because for all of the reasons that you cite and for the basic overall reason that it's a lot of things that happen in the United States affect Canada. One thing that always has interested me is that it seems that in a curious way the United States plays a role in the way Canada defines its identity, because Canadians like to say, whatever we are, we're not the United States. maybe that's just an American perspective, but to me that seems to be true. Do you think that
sure,
that is
true? True. It's inescapable given the relative sizes of the two countries, their degree of economic integration, and their very similarity. And it was true virtually from the start, at least from the start of the British definition of Canada. The founding English-speaking peoples of Canada were United Empire Loyalists. An early and, I think, for that point in history, the largest politically motivated refugee migration in history to that date. And so that's right at the core of defining what Canada is, and it has kind of continued in that way ever since. it gets a little tedious after a while. Even I admit that. But it's there, and it's inescapable. And the relationship also becomes a way of talking about domestic politics. So just as Brits might talk about class when they want to discuss how it is that they organize social policy, for us, we talk about the U.S. So the U.S. these days, for the left, for example, is the U.S. is kind of the capitalism rampant, the archetype of what you don't want to be in terms of the substance of policy. Often this leads us to actually grossly mischaracterize the situation on both sides of the border. For example, environmental policy tends to be quite a bit more advanced in the U.S. than in Canada. We're just saved by the fact that we're a country full of rocks and trees, and we could absorb a lot of gases and stuff that simply fall on the streets in the U.S.
Well, at that, I think we'll finish. I want to thank you very much, Professor Johnston, for talking with us today. We appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Our guest, Richard Johnston, he's professor of political science at the University of British Columbia.